Okay, Madam Chair, the webinar has been started and we are recording and broadcasting. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone, to the July 11th meeting of the Delta Independent Science Board. I'm going to give you a quick overview of the public comment process. We'll take written questions and comments, follow instructions on your screen to share those with us. And it's also on the meeting notice if you're not seeing the screen. And let's just start with roll call. So I'll just read off names. Tanya.
Tanya Heikkilä, no new declarations.
Tom.
Tom Holzer, no new declarations.
Bob. Not hearing you, Bob. Are you muted?
Bob Nightman, no new declarations. Sorry about that.
No worries. Obey.
Jayanta Obeysekara, no new declarations.
Kenny.
Because I missed it last time, I'm going to repeat it this time. On July 19th, I'm giving a presentation to the National Academy of Sciences as a public webinar about, before I joined the ISB, I was the lead writer of a review of the long-term operations effects analysis.
Very good. Thanks.
You're all welcome. I think you got invitations or a link to join.
That's great, Kenny. Thanks. Inga.
Sorry. Inga Werner, no new declarations. And sorry about the noise in the background, if you can hear it.
Not too bad. And I'm Lisa Wanger. I have no new declarations. Okay, we'll move on to housekeeping, and I'm going to turn it over to Margo Mattson for the instructions.
Lisa, Diane and Virginia are here now.
Well, thanks. I can't see everyone. Okay, Diane, please introduce yourself and say whether you have declarations.
I am Diane McKnight, and I have no new declarations. Thank you.
And Virginia.
Good morning. This is Virginia Dale. I have no new declarations.
Great. Okay, let's move on to Margo's role. Thanks, Margo.
Hi, just a reminder that in the event of an evacuation at the resources building, everyone should remain calm and take all of your belongings and proceed to the nearest exit to exit the building. Staff will gather at the evacuation point located at 1615 9th Street, and the public is welcome to join. Please note that there's no food or beverages allowed in the meeting room. Thank you.
Now I'm muted. Thank you, Margo. And I'll just give a quick overview of the agenda. We have a nice, succinct meeting today. So our agenda items are to discuss the status of our thematic reviews, and we'll spend the most time, most likely, on the subsidence review draft. And then just a note that we have moved the chair election, which was originally scheduled for this meeting, to August 15th. And I'll just check in with Edmund. Are there any public comments on initial?
Yep, there are none.
Okay, great. So we will move on to agenda item 2, which is the ISB chair's report and business matters. Since our last meeting, I worked with Tanya Heikkilä to address comments from our discussion on the Delta Plan 5-year review, and we submitted the comment letter to the Delta Stewardship Council staff. We are planning, so that's being taken care of. We are planning to review and comment on the draft Delta Adapts Adaptation Plan, but we're waiting for the public release of that report. We will receive a presentation from the Delta Stewardship Council staff in the near future on the draft environmental justice paper, and that will be an opportunity to give informal feedback and have discussion. And then we are still waiting for individual ISB members to submit their comments on the final EIR for the Delta Conveyance Project. That's comments on the comments. And those should be in to staff by the end of the month. And then I'll draft a comment letter for discussion at a future meeting. So that's where we are at with a lot of ongoing products. We did receive one piece of correspondence from California Water Research documenting evidence for increased wetness in the future. And so we appreciate getting that information. And Edmund, do we have any public comments on this item?
There are none.
Okay, great. So moving on to our third agenda item, the Delta Lead Scientist Report. And we have with us today Lisa Wendham Myers, who is going to give us a brief presentation.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair Wanger, for the invitation and for all of you for being here this morning to listen to this report. It has been a busy last 3 months. You'll see the lead scientist reports attached here. I think Edmund has them to share from the Delta Stewardship Council meetings. And since our last, my last presentation to you in April, I have been appointed to the full 3-year position. So I will be continuing to develop the vision that I'm going to present to you in September. And so I just let you know, I'll see you again in September for that. All right, the next slide, please. Thank you so much. So you know all these core functions. I just want to highlight for the Delta Science Program, the ones I'm going to focus on today are just a few areas where we've made some key products and or brought together some workshops and team building. So I will focus on these topics and I'll take the next slide. Thank you so much. So within the next 15 minutes or so, I'll be going through things that have happened, places you may have seen us or you will see us in the fall, funding opportunities that are open, workshops and community events, including adaptive management site visit that happened for the Sassoon Adaptive Management Advisory Team, where we are with Delta Science Plan updates, particularly with the grand challenges that you heard about last meeting. So I'll just only briefly discuss that. Peer review. I'm going to not spend too much time on all the products that we've put out recently, but I will focus on the recent one that came out for summer fall habitat action. And then some outreach that staff and I have been involved with for the program. So next slide, please. Thank you. All right, conferences. As you all have already heard, we had the Interagency Ecological Program meeting and you actually sent a nice letter on that. All of the talks are available now on the website, the YouTube site, and so I highly recommend watching them. So please avail yourself of these web links that I'm providing here. Another conference that happened in May was the State of the Estuary Conference. We had a strong presence there, 3 organized sessions, 4 presentations by staff, and those are not live, but upon request, you can certainly get copies of our presentations. The last one I wanted to highlight was the Delta Science Program and UC Davis Coastal and Marine Science Institute workshop that was on food webs. And as you know, this was presented at by me. I gave a keynote in partnership with Matt Young from USGS. And then we had several presentations, including from member Robert Nyman, Bob Nyman, but also one of our fellows, Megan Pagliaro, also gave a presentation, as well as one of our senior scientists, Denise Colombano. And those are all live, and you can look at these talks. And it was just a wonderful session that really got to the heart of the difficulties of using food web metrics for management decisions. Good conversation. And then I want to just plug again the Bay Delta Science Conference. As you might have noticed yesterday, they opened it up for registration. So again, these web links will take you there. And the schedule is coming together. It looks to be a really nice assortment of talks and well-linked concepts to really reach the goal of cultivating connections for this, our Delta environment, which we know is changing so rapidly. So next slide, please. Funding. All right. So we are moving forward with the research awards. The letters of intent were due about a month ago, and we got 83, which is a lot. Mm-hmm. The upcoming call is encouraging co-production and participatory research. And the when I say co-production and participatory research, I'm really talking about the researchers and the communities that are affected by the research working together to make effective, useful products. And so through this approach, to achieve this approach, we actually use very strong engagement methods to make sure that people were connected. The final proposals are due on August 28th, and that's when we'll know really what's going to be completed in terms of submissions. Right now, it looks like in total, people are asking for about $60 million, and we only have $6 million to distribute. And as of right now, it's looking like impressive submissions. We're looking forward to these new projects starting in 2025. And that said, we will also save some projects that, for example, if we aren't able to fund them, perhaps other agencies would be able to, because again, it's a really impressive list. And then another thing to plug is that with these research awards, we have implemented a requirement to present to the community. And so we've started this seminar series. As these 2021 projects are wrapping up, we've invited those PIs to give short webinars on their findings and their management implications. And so you just missed one yesterday that was on migratory fish. And I'll talk about that because I want to make sure you know about these webinars. So let's go to the next slide. Great. Okay. So we just had the sixth in this series, and I'm not privy to the, what's it called? The list of who attended. So I know you all had interest in the HABs, the harmful algal bloom presentation from 2 weeks ago. And so it's possible some of you attended that. And if you have any comments on this, I'd love to hear them. These have actually been incredibly well received both by the presenters and the community so far when we look at the exit polls. And so here's just an overview of what you see if you zoom in on the YouTube page and go look at some of these talks. The first thing to highlight is that these talks are meant to have a management focus. Some of them do that more strongly than others, but they all do at some level. And the questions that come in are often on a management question, the management angles of the research. So it's worth it to listen to the questions in the end, but the talks themselves are only 15 minutes. And so it's really, you know, a bite-size approach to this large, you know, multi-year data collection and stories to tell. And so I really do think that these are worth watching. So the first two on May 30th, I'm just going to talk through them really briefly, was Stefan Taki talking about leveraging tide gauges and water level gauges through the entire Delta to tell a more explicit and long-term story. So more temporal, going back in time to like the 1800s, as well as more extensive spatially, not just talking about where we have, for example, NOAA gauges. And some of the highlights of that were just showing, you know, rapid subsidence in places like the Western Sassoon, and then also in the South Delta. So you need to think about Stockton, for example, being a coastal city. It has a very strong relative sea level rise response. It's starting to decline compared to sea level. Baumgarten, Sean Baumgarten, spelled wrong here, I'm sorry about that, presented for himself and Lydia Vaughn and for Letitia Grenier for the Sassoon Landscapes Project, the historical landscapes. And that was a community effort to basically start pulling together kind of a similar thing to what the historical Delta mapping has shown, and let us look back in time at what Sassoon looked like and then what it, and to also reimagine its future, again, hearing from the community. So those are both good presentations. The next one on Wednesday, June 5th was Dr. Wilmus and Flora Portiglione, and they both presented on the use of historic midden data on otoliths to be able to tell the life histories of salmon in these different reaches of California. It's just so profound. It's a data set that I wasn't aware of before. So I highly recommend listening to that one. And then Alex Forrest presented on the temperature control device that's at Shasta Dam, and basically how it's operating and where small savings in water flow, small savings in efficiency, understanding how it works, can lead to a longer release of cold water into November, for example. So really getting at the efficiency of water release and where the temperature control device could be improved. The third session was on was very carbon focused. So multi-benefit wetland habitat and delta food webs. Dennis Baldacci talked about the Eddy Covariance Network that he maintains in the Delta and all of the implications of different, basically the trade-offs of different land management effects. And so those are worth listening to, again, to get a sense of where they are and where they're going to apply to land management decisions. And then Dr. Peter Hernes also presented on carbon, in particular on alloctonous carbon and autochthonous carbon in the Delta. So how carbon pools in the Delta are being used by food webs and how we see that change with different flow regimes. Basically with higher flow, we're seeing more alloctonous carbon coming in, and that's a potentially a part of the food web that we haven't been considering. And then the next talks were, actually we lost one of our talks, and so we had only a single talk, and it was by John Takakawa. This one went longer than 15, and it's a really good one because he talks about the Phragmites invasion in Sassoon Marsh. But then in particular, he goes into the community that's affected by this and how working with them can lead to better control, and then also better understanding of the implications of that invasion. So a very community-focused effect their approach was to involve the community in making decisions about or making interpretations about what the effects are and where to go from here. So the next one after that was about 2 weeks ago. That was the harmful algal blooms talks, and those are again definitely worth watching for those of you interested in harmful algal bloom status of what we know. The first one was on aerosolization, and that was Hans Perl's project. And then Haley Ploss gave the talk and did one thing that we actually really enjoyed, which was the she put plain language for the public underneath all of the highlights of the science slides. And so it made it very easy to understand the implications of what they were finding through incubations and so on, and emissions and so on. The second talk there was by Keith Buma Gregson. And I know you heard last week or last month about the MERHAB project, particularly the harmful algal bloom monitoring strategy. Keith is basically talking specifically about what he's been finding about trying to link remote sensing and the SPAT, the toxin measurements, and all of the other metrics, including species and so on. So it's a really nice set of talks. There's also then yesterday we had the two talks that were on basically both on salmon and basically on predation and also a transponder network. I'm pulling together all that database so that more people can work with the acoustic telemetry data to tell stories about how fish are moving. And one of the key things that was presented by Dr. Massey was the covariates, the role of the water flows and then temperature on the predation risks and how the striped bass migration then affected survival. So of salmon. So that said, we are now looking, and Jasmine Williamson of Kramer Fish Science presented on a directed research project that was actually building out a database for uploading and downloading found transponders so that more people can use that data. So that said, next week, I hope you can join us for the last one, which is, sorry for all the beeping. The next one is going to be focused on, I had it at the tip of my tongue a second ago, but the first one is on defining success in restoration in terms of food webs for microbes to zooplankton. Let's, you know, how do you define a beneficial wetland? And then the second one is on eDNA as a monitoring technique for tidal wetland restoration. So again, that's next week. And then some of the ones that we had to move from this year that got moved to next spring are Renee Henry's Reorienting to Recovery, again, a salmon-focused project. And then there's two other presentations by Dr. Buchanan and Dr. Perry, University of Washington, and then also USGS on also fish-related presentations, including standard operating procedures for telemetry and so on. Okay, next slide. Thank you. Okay, so there we go. The next thing to note is that the letters of intent or the notices of intent have come in for the Delta Science, for the next round of Delta Science fellows. And we got 37 this year. We usually get about 17. So this is really great for this crop coming in. Those actual applications are due August 26th. So we'll see then how many actually do get submitted. But I think, as we know, this is a really useful fellowship and track for any scientists that are interested in integrating science and policy. And we really look forward to seeing who comes in next, because we've had such success with past fellows. There was an early career leadership workshop in May, and the focus of it was on science communication. And just that part alone, I know, made a big difference for the fellows, for that last crop of fellows, the 2021 fellows. And many of them basically said it was one of the highlights of their entire experience, along with mentoring and other things that were beneficial from the fellowship. Okay, next slide. Thank you. All right, I also want to plug the Science for Communities workshop. So switching gear from funding into community building. This is next, this is tomorrow. And it's not just in hot Stockton, it's also hybrid. So if you would like to attend, there is a web link for that. Next slide, please. And the focus of this is to basically hear from the community and also share with the community what ideas we have basically start having better affiliations with tribal needs and community needs. So it's more of a planning event, which is providing an opportunity to connect with community-based organizations and scientists to discuss social environmental issues that impact communities at the Delta. The goal is to foster partnerships. So there's an opportunity to talk about specific research needs, specific research tools, and how they might be used. And I think we're almost back to it. Thank you so much for finding the slides. Great. Yeah, this is the slide we want. Great. Thank you. And this is something we're hoping to do every 2 years. So this is the second time this has happened. In the past, in the 2022 Science for Community workshop, we focused on topics such as bioaccumulation of pollutants in aquatic organisms, water quality, unhoused populations, and environmental justice in HABs. And then this year, there's four organizations that we're particularly partnering with project topics on air quality, climate change, harmful algal blooms, toxic fish consumption, and impacts of flooding in the Delta. So additionally, there's going to be other seminars at the workshop, some led by our staff, to ensure the continuation of Delta co-production of research and connecting with youth from the community in particular. So the youth panel is actually going to have project presentations on social environmental issues from a broad range of attendees. The funding resources panel is going to be led by Rachel Klopfenstein, and the Strategic Growth Council and Delta Science Program will discuss the funding opportunities, lessons learned, partnership agreements, templates, like how do you do this, and grants reviews for community researchers, scientists, and other grant recipients. So the idea is to just really broaden the community, which is one of our larger goals. And then there's also going to be a networking hall. And this time we're going to do networking with presenters and organizations, sharing tables for this entire event. And that's in person. But again, you can attend the talks with the hybrid link. And I will make sure that you have access to that if you don't already. And I think I can move to the next slide. Thank you. Great. So let me just talk about the recent meeting that happened at with the Rush Ranch Nature Center. So this adaptive management team that's run by Dr. Dylan Chappell, he's the program manager here. They have quarterly meetings for adaptive management in the Sassoon region. And this one focused on three projects, one that's in its planning stages, that's Goat Island, one that's already completed and we are following it. It just started and so we're just starting to monitor it through time. That's the Lower Spring Branch Creek restoration. And then finally, and those are both within the Sassoon Rush Ranch area of Grizzly Bay, that zone, you can walk to those. But the Montezuma Wetlands was farther away and then we drove to that one and got a really nice presentation by the Volmar Natural Lands Consulting group who has been monitoring this through time and actually seen a lot of progress. So this AMAT, which you'll get more of a presentation on later if you're interested, because Dylan Chappell would like us to start highlighting it more. It's an important function of our Delta Science program. The meeting was well attended by representatives of state, federal, and local agencies. So there was a lot good discussion, good representation, and then even follow-up questions and so on. The meeting began at the Rush Ranch Nature Center, which is a great place to hold a meeting if you're ever thinking about having one out there. There was an introductory presentation by Stuart Siegel, who was representing the San Francisco Bay National Estuarine Research Reserve, which does the science coordination for that site. And the talk that he gave was on adaptive management of the planned tidal wetland restoration at Goat Island, as well as that completed wet restoration project at Lower Spring Branch. He shared plans, he shared how integration of public access features were going to happen, how the design features were intended to promote ecological processes. And we walked through the sites. In the end, that's where my long-term eddy covariance tower is, out at the historic, the ancient, Holocene level marsh out at Sassoon, out there at Rush Ranch. And so we talked about greenhouse gas monitoring there and what the long-term data are showing. And then after we did that walk, we went over to the Montezuma wetland site. And the focus of that work, which started 20 years ago, was to reverse subsidence in the marsh by beneficial reuse of dredged sediment from San Francisco Bay. And it's self-funded, which is really interesting, by fees associated with sediment disposal, which is a kind of a win from the community. It has successfully reversed the effects of subsidence caused by peat decomposition in phase one, and it now has created 600 acres of vegetated intertidal wetland habitat that is actively used by native fish and migratory birds, which we saw many of in May. So this was a really successful site meeting to pull the community together and actually discuss, you know, how do you do adaptive management and what are our data showing so far and how do we want to improve that? Okay, next slide, please. Thank you. All right, the Grand Challenges essay. I only put this slide up to remind you that comments are due tomorrow. If you would like to put information in at this phase, but we are really looking forward to hearing from you, the board, on this approach to structuring the Delta Science Plan update that will happen. Something will come out next fall, but we're going to start having this fall. We will start having community workshops, pulling together, taking all the comments that we've gotten so far this spring, and then having that happen. And this work is being led by Tricia Lee, who I know that you've had a good presentation from the last DISB meeting. Okay, next slide, please. Thank you. All right, so peer reviews. This again is a essential part of the Delta Science Program. As you know, we recently completed the long-term operations effects analysis review, and that was Dr. Kenny Rose who led that, and he will be presenting on that a week from tomorrow to the National Academies. All of that work is viewable online, the charge and all of the responses. And in that case, they came up with a single letter that was led by Dr. Rose. The one I want to focus on right now is the one that we did for the Department of Water Resources on summer-fall habitat action. And in particular, this is for Delta smelt, and it's a focus on the independent review that was required for the incidental take permit that they were granted from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. So the focus was on suitable habitat for juvenile and subadult Delta smelt. And so water flow actions that would be used to improve habitat, such as reduced salinity and more zooplankton production. And in the end, we ended up with four independent letters, two of which are focused on food webs and two of which are focused on the structured decision-making that was used. And there was some consensus amongst those reviews, amongst the pairs of reviews, with the food webs experts, which is Dr. Isa Wu, Dr. Lars Rudstrom, and both of them really highlighted some improved monitoring ideas that they thought could be integrated, in particular zooplankton detection with basically cameras, and then also flora probes and low-cost sensors for salinity and temperature, things that that wouldn't cost too much but would really improve the interpretation of the action effects. And so those were some of the key findings of the food webs folks. Then the structured decision making folks, that was Dr. Kelly Robinson and Dr. Robin Gregory, and they had similar interests in terms of where they thought the structured decision making worked well and where it could be improved. And some of the improvements they suggested were things like framing, so more coordination with other agencies to frame the decisions that are being made, and then also a more formal evaluation of uncertainty, which Dr. Robinson thought needed a little bit more attention, particularly in this changing climate. And then we can go to the next slide. And so towards changing climate on this next slide, I want to highlight that the next National Academies review meeting, which is coming up April 12th, is going to focus on climate change effects on long-term operations. And so we expect that not only are they interested in Dr. Rose's report, we do expect them to also be looking at the DWR peer review letters that have come in from the four letters I just described. So just to put this in past, I just want you to, again, be aware of NASM coming up, and then also how we will be integrating with that. Again, Dylan Stern from our program coordinates our involvement and all of those types of interactions. Okay, next slide, please. Thank you. And this is my last, you know, meaty slide. And I just wanted to highlight that I did present, I was invited by a state water master, Jay Ziegler, to do the quarterly update. This is all available on YouTube. And some of the things that the water board are interested in pursuing are, they're looking forward to that National Academies report for their own work. They're looking forward to collaborative science more, interacting with the Delta Stewardship Council to really build out a more collaborative approach to science that they can use. And they've also gotten very interested in remote sensing as an independent metric to basically look at water flows and quality. So for example, they've really operationalized OpenET, which is an evapotranspiration way, model intercomparison, or consolidation, that then allows better tracking of consumptive use of water. They're also interested in, you know, color, things like they're funding the HABs, improvement of remote sensing of harmful algal blooms through different remotely sensed water quality metrics, whether it's turbidity or chlorophyll and so on. And then the last one is SWOT. So the surface water ocean topography satellite that went up about a year ago, and just the results are just starting to come out. They're actually going to be on a USGS portal released this fall. And the potential for that to measure discharge from space, actual flows by using water levels, is just a real game changer for both for modelers and then also for, or should I say, model validation, as well as for compliance. So that's going to be a very useful remotely sensed product in the future. Okay, next thing would be the Chesapeake Community Research Consortium. We had presence there from Ben Geske, one of our senior engineers, and he came back glowing about how impressive the meeting was and how partnering with the Chesapeake research scientists and this consortium could really help us move forward. This consortium sounds a lot like the Bay Delta Science Conference in terms of its structure and how many different topics come together. Harmful algal blooms was one that he highlighted from that, and that's something that we will pursue with Chesapeake scientists for collaboration on both monitoring as well as potential remediation and mitigation options. The last thing I want to highlight is here that's Delta specific is the Brown Nichols Award. The nominations are due on Monday, and the final results will be announced at the Bay Delta Science Conference. So we do hope that you're aware of that. And if you have any submissions that, or you can spread the word that we were really looking actively for a broad range of applicants for this. This is, again, a scientist who has made a real impact on Bay Delta management and community building through their science work. And then finally, it's been mentioned to me that I should mention this. So I will be gone next week. I'm headed to Washington, D.C. for something, a grant that I was one of the co-leads on for a Community for Data Integration, which is the USGS and the US EPA. We are trying to get basically inland wetlands into the National Greenhouse Gas Inventory. I was part of the group that got coastal wetlands in. And so now we're shooting for inland wetlands, which is a very difficult thing to do. But we have 40 people across agencies. Again, this data integration across teams is the focus. And so, making good use of the new U.S. Greenhouse Gas Center, which is another huge improvement in terms of agency interaction. So I would highly recommend being there. And I think I will be talking a bit about that at the Bay Delta Science Conference as well. All right. And then the last slide is thanks. And if there's any questions on any topics I brought up, I'll be happy to take them. And next slide is fine. Thank you, Margo, for doing this.
Well, that was great, Lisa Marie. You've really caught us up on a lot of activities, and we appreciate that. We didn't let you talk for many meetings, so you had a lot to present. Yeah, let's just see if the board has questions. I think it was a bit of a fire hose, so it may be tough for us to go back and think about our individual questions, but let's see if anyone. Bob.
Thanks, Lisa Marie. That was a comprehensive and just an excellent presentation, a great overview. I really appreciate it. I only have really one question, and that is, it looks as though your funding for the independent research is declining a lot. It's went from, I think, 17 million down to 6 million. Is there, well, can you tell us about the reason for that decline and any plans to try and turn that around?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Bob. The decline isn't as profound as the lack of partnership. So we used to partner with the Division of Fish and Wildlife and Bureau of Rec to fund additional proposals, and that really broadened out our pot of funding. But we're under a very strict limit, and we try to hold on to that 6 million very, very hard against the tide of loss. So there was no way to grow it this year. But I would say 6 million is our minimum. And so towards growing it, it's right now probably going to have to be through partnerships with other agencies that have interests in the types of research that's being proposed. So there's no real way to build it out within the Stewardship Council's budget, but there is through partnerships. So
you have plans then to increase the number of partnerships for the coming years?
Yes, and there's actually programs being built out with Department of Water Resources, with Bureau of Reclamation, and with State Water Board that could pick up projects that couldn't be funded through our limited pool.
Great. All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for asking.
Yeah. Good to hear. Diane.
I have a follow-up question to Bob's then in response to your helpful answer, Lisa Marie. So how will the individuals who are writing these proposals know about the potential partnerships? I was a program officer at NSF for a long time, and if it's just hit or miss as people propose for research, they don't know which other agency, that can be an impediment. Mm-hmm. Especially if you have $60 million of research proposals and only $6 million, that can discourage future submissions. So is there a strategy for that to disseminate ahead of the deadlines? I'm getting into the weeds about how this works, but it can make a big difference.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I agree. I don't want to to discourage any submissions. We do know, and we've made it clear that this particular call is going to focus on co-produced science, so very community focused. You basically get extra points in the analysis for having a community-based need and partner, and making that clear. So that is the focus of the small pot that we have, but we don't those relationships with USBR and DWR and so on, they're not solid. Like there really isn't a distinct pot that we know that we're going for that we can actually call for. And we did not get their partnership in the initial release. So it's really it is an ad hoc after the fact thing that we see the value. It's a very impressive list that's come in. And so we are hoping to just basically forward out those that we can't submit that we can't support, and then see if they get picked up by other agencies. So there's no real direct way to quantify that. It's just a hope that they get picked up. So I know it's not satisfying.
Thank you though.
Okay.
And Lisa Marie, I'll just ask a process question too. So it's great to see the results of prior funding being shared with the science community, and great that you started that seminar series. Do you have any sort of structured or semi-structured way of taking the results of funded projects and bringing them into management committees, like making sure people review that and use that information? How does that work?
Oh, great question. Well, the Delta Science Tracker is our way of sharing the research that's been done. But yeah, there's not, I would say that the Bay Delta Science Conference is a place, it's very management focused in terms of the types of presentations that we were, you know, we request that people include that in their presentations. This seminar series is the first that I've seen of being really clearly asking, please distill all of your work into some really clear messages of how this can be used and how which agencies might want to know about what you've found. So there isn't another. I'm sure I'm forgetting something, but we have a lot of outreach events where we share things, and we also obviously post things on Science Tracker and we highlight publications, but we don't have anything else, I think, as targeted in terms of, you know, having the scientists talk directly about the management implications of their work. So this is kind of it, and it's going so well that I'm sure we'll A, continue it, and B, maybe expand it.
That's great. Well, I'll open it up to public comments then if there are no other questions from the board. Last call, unless you think of something after the public comments. Edmund, do we have any public comments or questions?
There are none.
Okay. Well, Lisa Marie, thank you for that update. I'm sure we'll have some follow-up questions, you know, as we dig into some more of those details, as, you know, as things come up more individually. But we really did really appreciate that overview. Very helpful.
Glad to share. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Bye-bye. Okay, now we will move on to agenda item 5, where we will discuss the Food Webs review. And let me just give a little bit of background before turning it over to Bob. So the Delta Independent Science Board recently received public comments on its draft review, and these comments explored scientific and management implications of the upper trophic level food webs in the Delta, the comments and the report. The draft was based on a review of the literature on the subject of upper trophic level food webs, and then also public comments on the prospectus and at Delta ISB meetings. We had discussions, and then finally the focus 2-day workshop. So the goal of this review is to provide information that would help organizations such as state and federal agencies assess how to better incorporate and advance food web knowledge in managing the Delta's ecosystems, and to identify what tools are available or possibly should be developed. We received the following public comments. So Sam Beshevkin from the State Water Resources Control Board sent a letter, DWR, the Sacramento Area Sewer District, Steve Culberson, Delta Conservancy, and the San Joaquin Audubon Society. And now we'll get a status update from the review leads on addressing comments. So Bob, you want to start?
Sure. Thanks, Lisa. I've worked through all the comments received so far, including some informal ones that came in emails. And as you might imagine, they range from very simple corrections or references that the reviewers felt that we'd overlooked, to some fairly complex ones that are going to require perhaps a bit more discussion and thought. But I have made progress probably on a good 80 to 90% of the comments. And I've reached out and asked Kenny to help with a few of the comments that specifically addressed modeling. And Kenny and I will probably get together sometime next week or exchange information And once I have that information in hand, I will start revising the entire report and hopefully have it available for everyone to look at in, let's say, 2 to 3 more weeks. So anyway, we're making sustained and steady progress, good progress. And I should say that the comments we did receive, they were all excellent. They were really helpful in pulling this together. And some of them were, as you you know, were kind of difficult to respond to, but also makes one think about what we're really saying from time to time. And I think we've fixed all of those and provided, you'll see a lot more clarity in the coming revised report. So anyway, that's all there is for the moment. Look for something maybe in another 2 to 3 weeks, but knowing how we work together, it may be a little bit longer. So, or how the process works. So maybe a little bit longer, but making good progress. So I don't know if
that's good.
Any comments?
Yeah, that's good to hear. First, I want to see if Kenny had any comments.
No, but I think I got the hard comments to deal with. I'm not accusing Bob of anything, but I'm working on it, and I'm actually have text. But I know I'm in a little bit of trouble when I read my own text the next day, and I'm not sure what I was saying. So. It's not quite ready yet to send to Bob, but it will be early next week. So.
Sounds good. And Bob, do you agree with the statement that, you know, we did get a substantial number of comments, and, you know, one of the reasons why we're not going through them in the meeting is that they're really very quite numerous, but we will have a chance to review the responses, you know, substantive responses when we discuss the review, right?
Yes, that's right. And broken out all the comments and put them in to a combined table and then with initial responses, and we'll revise our responses as we go along. But just to give you a sense of the scope of the table, it right now, I think it's 28 pages long. We've received enough comments to make a table that is substantial. And each and every comment is being carefully considered, and you know, and how to how to use the comment in making the report better.
That's great. Well, it also shows a lot of interest in this topic, so mm-hmm. Nice to see. Yeah. All right, any questions or comments from the board, and then we'll open it up for public comments. Okay, seeing none, do we have any public comments, Edmund?
There are none.
Okay. All right. Well, we look forward to getting more details on that and at a future meeting. We won't, we're guessing it's more like September, not August. So we'll see when that shows up. Okay. So we'll go on to our next agenda item number 6, which is a discussion of decision-making under deep uncertainty review. And so the update here is that, we'll just remind folks first that the review builds on an understanding of the scientific tools and concepts that can increase the capacity to anticipate and adapt to growing uncertainty of future conditions in the Bay Delta system. So it's nice to see that Lisa Marie referred to this. Many, many people who come before us now seem to recognize that there is this growing uncertainty of future conditions, and what are some of our options for managing that uncertainty and keeping making decisions despite the uncertainty. And this review had two main components. We had a seminar series where we invited experts to come in and tell us about their state of the art work. And then we also did an inventory and analysis of how scenario planning is used in the region, because scenario planning can play a very vital role in the analysis of uncertainty. So Kyra Wallace, who was the previous ISB fellow, prepared a draft summary of the seminar series over the past year. And based on the discussion in April, we will release the draft summary prior to the completion of the review. So there's an interim product that'll come out. The status there is that the review leads are still working to address the comments from the last meeting and are targeting an August release. But I think that's in pretty good shape, and we're just dotting some I's there. And then the other update is that Shoko Shinbrot and Margot Mattson and the rest of the team have completed interviews with scenario developers and are now conducting interviews with scenario users. So we're getting both sides, you know, who the people who created it, how did they create it? And then are the users finding what they did useful, and how is that information being used with respect to understanding uncertainty? And they've completed 7 interviews with scenario users. One was rescheduled, and they need to reschedule that, and they're hoping to do at least 3 more. And they will share their findings at a future meeting. So that's where we are with that. And then, of course, the final review report will be developed once we have all these analyses finished. So any questions or comments there? Probably need a lot more information to be able to comment. And then, Edmund, do we have any public comments?
There are none.
All right. Well, I suggest we take a 20-minute break at this point, and then we'll come back refreshed to discuss the subsidence review, which is the one that will be more substantive. And you all received the draft, and we'll prepare for that. So please meet back at 20 minutes after the hour, 10:20, and we will continue the conversation. I'm ready.
Okay, Madam Chair, we are recording and broadcasting.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to the Delta Independent Science Board July 11th meeting. And before we get started, I'd just like Anna to do roll call.
Thank you, Lisa. And I apologize for not being able to be here for the first hour of the meeting. But my name is Anna McCulloch, and I have no new declarations.
Thanks, Anna. We're glad you could join us. How even a little late. And now we'll start on the next agenda item, which is a discussion of the subsidence review. And let me just give a brief background before turning it over to Tom. So folks will remember on October 19th to 20th, 2023, we conducted a public workshop in Sacramento that focused on the basic and applied science that could improve management of subsided lands in the Delta. And in the meeting packet, you have a copy of the subsidence review draft. And I'm going to turn it over to Tom now to provide an overview of the report and lead a discussion to decide whether this is ready to go out for public comments after our comments are addressed. So Tom, take it away.
All righty. What we're going to do is I'm going to give a brief overview of the history of the Delta and the report. I wanted to say a few words about the report structure, and then I'll review the first findings and recommendations, and Diane will do the next one, and Tanya will do that. So we're going to do this as a team. I think it's really important on this topic to appreciate how we got into the current situation. About 150 years ago, people began to dewater the marshes that were the undisturbed estuary of the Delta. And they started building levees to keep the water out of these farms. And that's the way it pretty much went, bringing us up to the present. And today, the levee program is really the answer that we're using to the subsidence problem. And what this workshop was all about is, and I think it's important to look at the Delta for the next 150 years, what's going to be happening. And the issue is, sea level is going to rise. Lisa talked about it earlier today in her talk. Is I think it was one of the presentations, 15-minute presentations she discussed. But what we're seeing is a future that is going to certainly involve higher sea levels at the scale of 150 years, significantly higher sea levels, although the precise values are uncertain. And so what's happened in the Delta, people are beginning to look at how subsidence can be managed by bringing water into it. And this really sort of started in 1997. And today we have rather isolated experiments that focus on bringing the water in. Now, what the report attempted to do was summarize the results from a workshop. And I talked about it a little, a few meetings ago, where we just talked about the structure. We tried to do it a little bit differently. And let's see, I can, the contents here. We've written a report that's structured this way because it's really addressed to management. And it sort of has two sections to it. The first section is the findings and recommendations preceded by a problem statement. And that's really what we think our audience is looking at. The second section is basically the workshop. We've written summaries of the individual talks, and the workshop itself is online. There's a link to that so that the reader who wants to dig a little bit deeper can look at that information. But really the focus of the report is on these findings and recommendations. And they're all centered around basically bringing water into the Delta to address this subsidence problem. And I might mention that the levee effort is a very expensive thing. I've heard numbers of over $1 billion for the modern upgrades and repairs to the Delta. And I'll just say it once again, at 150 years out, of course, there's some uncertainty with it, but we're looking at multiple feet of sea level rise. And we don't usually plan for these kind of distant futures, but I think for the Delta, you could argue it's a special case. We've already had 150 years of experience with what farming and living in the Delta means. And I think it is just prudent to be taking a longer term look. So that's what we're about. Okay, well, let me turn to the first finding and recommendation. And it's focused on subsidence management and research. And there's really sort of three themes within that. The efforts that are currently active in the Delta, it's remarkable how well connected they are. It's a relatively small community, and the people seem to be working with each other and talking to each other. But there's no formal overall coordination of these efforts or where we're trying to go. And so the recommendation is that we need that kind of coordination and probably a strategic long-term research program for the Delta. Because one of the things we're learning is that, for example, by inundating an island and causing the subsidence to actually reverse, subsidence reversal, this is a new thing. And what's going to happen over the long term, how quickly the vegetation decays, all that kind of stuff should be monitored, because there's clearly going to be a need for adaptive management based on the science during that. There's also a need to look at polluticulture and particularly rice growing. That seems to be a very efficient way to at least slow down and maybe even reverse subsidence, but we need to monitor that and document it. And then we need to ensure that we maintain expertise, this is kind of subsidence is kind of a specialized study, and we probably need something like an experiment station in the Delta that is actually committed to long-term monitoring of these effects. So what we've done then is tried to write a section here at the beginning of the report that really gets to the what's needed and doesn't spend a lot of time documenting the science behind it. That actually comes later. And the reason we did that was to make it a little more palatable to managers. And we've had some legislative interest in it as well. So I think it'll tend to focus on that. With that, I'll turn it over to Diane to talk briefly about the biogeochemistry of the greenhouse gases.
Thank you, Tom. And Tom's explanation of the overall structure of the report and the audience is really important. And as I encourage you all to consider that as you read this biogeochemistry section. Needless to say, it's been a challenge to try to summarize in a finding the complexity of the biogeochemical processes in the context that are relevant here. So we have both the pointing out how greenhouse gas, reducing greenhouse gas production and enhancing carbon sequestration are both important considerations in this context of reversing or addressing subsidence. And in the findings, our goal has been, and again, I thank other members of the committee or the lead, and Lauren and Edmund for their, and Lisa Marie for helping with this, to explain what the trade-offs might be in terms of both sequestering carbon as organic material as we reverse, as subsidence is reversed, and then trying to understand what would be the immediate effects in terms of greater release of methane and potentially other accessory greenhouse gas constituents. So we point out that while the basic chemistry, biogeochemistry is generally understood, one phrase we might add is the devil is in the details as there's planning for management. And so we have in this findings, we point out the important role of N2O, for example, as this other greenhouse gas that is difficult to measure. And we also point out how there may be, there appears to be a slowing down of greenhouse gas release as organic matter is accumulated in the newly formed wetland material, and also that some other solutes, or sulfate, may limit as well the amount of methane produced. So the two figures that are associated with the findings here are essentially placeholders. And you may, for example, look at the statement that says, pointing out the differences in half-life between a methane and CO2 and N2O. And then we cite figure three. And then if you look at figure three, it's not clear how figure three explains that, but we would improve figure three. So, but which, so this figure three is not quite ready to be comprehended by some of the land managers, but we would tune that up. Similarly, the figure two is, if we can go there, is not, could be revised again to more directly support the, or be simplified. This is a figure from the an existing journal article. In terms of recommendations, we highlight the three areas that would be helpful for farmers and other land managers to fine-tune management in the near term. So there is a recognition that understanding these greenhouse gas emissions, especially methane, is particularly important as a research topic. The second one is promoting greater rates of accumulation and stabilization of organic matter. So these are understanding how to balance these two issues. And then the third area for recommendations for research within the scope of scientific recommendations has to do with developing more models that can be, are really targeted for scenario development and risk assessment, and more, not necessarily envisioning really complicated models, but the models that will help understand the near-term trade-offs. And then finally, in our second paragraph here in the recommendations, we highlight the importance of monitoring, maintaining year-round monitoring, because during the winter months, there may be production of methane or N2O, for example, that is slowed down. How do we deal with seasonal variation? And a greater understanding of this could be achieved in a couple of years. That would be really useful. So these are our recommendations. And again, there's much more detail in the summaries of the presentations that occurred in the workshop. So I also want to highlight that the two figures that are there would be refine, to similarly be more accessible.
Great. I think I'm up. So thanks, Tom and Diane. Good summaries of the first two sets of findings and recommendations. As Diane mentioned, the findings from the first portion of this draft report are largely based on what we heard from the science and evidence that came out of the workshop that we hosted. And that workshop is then summarized in the second section of the report, but we tried to put the findings and summary of those findings and recommendations up front to make it more accessible to the reader. And hopefully it is. So we'll find out, of course, in the discussion. But in terms of the findings on agricultural practices in the Delta, one thing that I think is really important to highlight here is that the vast majority of the land in the Delta is privately owned. And so when we're thinking about what are the mechanisms for addressing subsidence and mitigating subsidence, we have to understand what tools and approaches are available to those private landowners, which are largely farmers. And so a key finding here is that polluticulture or farming on rewetted soil can help minimize some of that further loss of soils and help mitigate subsidence. And that rice production is currently one of the most economical polluticulture options for those private lands in the Delta. And some of the farmers that we spoke with at the workshop indicated that the viability of shifting to rice depends a lot on the initial startup costs and whether or not the benefits of that type of production will pay off in the long term. So there's uncertainty right now with respect to how much those benefits can be conveyed to farmers and how much we can incentivize or could be incentivized to help shift those practices in the Delta. There's also land in the Delta, agricultural land, that's difficult to farm because of drainage and seepage issues. And one of the areas of discussion that came out in the workshop was that some of the subsidence could be reversed by conversion to wetlands, but the incentives again for shifting lands from agricultural production into managed wetlands need to be cost effective, and some of the regulatory issues can make that very challenging. So in terms of the recommendations we have for the agricultural practices, our focus here is on research that could inform these questions around management practices, largely on private agricultural lands. And so we've recommended that more research be done to help us assess and model the costs and benefits of rice production and other polluticulture options in the Delta, as well as what types of financial incentives could motivate Delta farmers to shift to rice production or other forms of polluticulture. And then also to do more research on what mechanisms can help knowledge sharing amongst the private landowners in the Delta about some of those economic benefits as well as sustainability benefits if rice production is viable. And then in terms of the managed wetlands, we also wanted to recommend that there be more research assessing what types of, again, incentives could motivate farmers to incorporate some of those managed wetlands on their lands. And we've identified some agencies that could provide leadership in either funding or supporting or engaging in this type of research here in the final portion of that recommendation section. And then we also have a section on landscape scale challenges. Tom, did you want to touch on those? Or? Oh, you're on mute, Tom. Tom, you're on mute.
Yeah, do you want to take a shot at it?
Sure, I'm happy to summarize those. So another key theme of the workshop that we identified were these landscape scale challenges. So we can think about how we maybe manage subsidence on a particular island or a particular location of privately owned land in the Delta, but without thinking about the landscape as a whole, we may be missing out on, what are the opportunities for really addressing subsidence at a more sustainable scale. So the challenges, of course, are that there's a lot of variation in the Delta in terms of the biophysical, demographic, land use characteristics within the Delta that can make these types of landscape scale assessments challenging, and also understanding kind of where you get the most bang for your buck in terms of investments in subsidence mitigation need to be understood. And we don't have adequate kind of quantification or modeling of these landscape scale questions. Related to that, we also don't have good information on how carbon markets can be used to help kind of incentivize some of these approaches and tools like wetland restoration or rice cultivation or other rewetting practices that could maybe play a role in some of these landscape scale changes that could lead to more sustainability in terms of subsidence mitigation. So our recommendations in this final section focus on quantifying or assessing the effects and trade-offs of the different kind of both public and private incentives that could be available for rewetting Delta lands, but also making sure that the research is available to understand how those types of mechanisms are aligned with priorities and values of the very different communities and landowners across the Delta. And that is essential for thinking about how we might develop landscape scale kind of land use and management practices. We recommend more research to assess the impact of different management practices like crop rotation, soil rewetting and drying, and greenhouse gas emissions and sequestration at the landscape scale, and then quantifying the degree to which those changes would support various ecological benefits or benefits towards levee stability and economic health of the communities. And then we have a final recommendation there on advancing kind of scientific understanding of the biogeochemical processes that influence the net greenhouse gas emissions associated with alternative landscape scenarios. So this ties back to some of the recommendations I think Diane already highlighted, but thinking about this again at the landscape scale. So I think that's it for our recommendations and findings.
Yeah, great job, Tanya and Diane. I just want to emphasize two of the points that Tanya alluded to. One, the private land issue is in this kind of problem is critical, because it whatever science you do, if it doesn't fit with what the landowners can use, then it really doesn't accomplish very much. And then the other thing is the carbon markets right now aren't necessarily designed very well for the way farmers farm in the Delta. For example, the time frame for the commitment is so long that it just doesn't make it it makes it a challenge for the farmer. So I think with those two points, we can open it up and get your reactions.
You going to call on us, Tom, or you want us to just dive in?
Why don't you moderate?
Okay, I'll moderate. But I'm going to call on myself first since I was quick with the hand. And it also segues nicely from what you just said. So first of all, I really liked your oral summaries. And I think some of the things I was looking for in the findings and recommendations you said, but maybe they didn't come across exactly as well in the writing. And so I have a few suggestions. Maybe it's just easier to send some of them. But one of the substantive comments is on page 13, where you talk about this alignment with property owners and allude to prices and of the carbon markets. I think this section could really benefit from just being a little more explicit about, are there carbon credits that are possible for these practices? You know, just being clear, like there are some carbon credits. I would even think that a separate paragraph on the markets might be appropriate, because right now you have it nested under the alignment with property owner management concerns, but it's not coming across very clearly. You know, are there credits or do we need more research? That's one question that wasn't clear from this summary. And then just connecting the dots a little more about, you know, the trade-offs and the limitations of using the credit market. And I can give you some more specific suggestions in writing if that's easier. But I my main comment is just to separate out this. There's issues of land management and then there's issues of carbon market, you know, being able to sell credits.
Yeah, I noticed a few times when we were editing, what would happen is we would end up doing that. Basically, you end up with a very short paragraph that brings all the information into one place and gives it more emphasis.
Yeah, I mean, you may not want to spend too much time on it, but it doesn't nest cleanly under just management concerns. Yeah, because you want to know specifically, could they sell credits if they wanted to? Yeah, okay. I'm done.
Yeah, the challenge here obviously is to keep things brief but still say it. So,
yeah, I think it could just be a little clearer. Go ahead, Kenny.
Yeah, so I looked through it, but of course this was started before I joined and everything. But one impression I got, and it's a bit critical, but you say a lot about a lot of research is needed, and it can come across that. We don't know much, and this is going to need, you know, and there's a lot of research topics. I did a quick search, and, you know, it occurs like 20 or 30 times in the recommendations or something like that. I would suggest either define what you mean by research in that context. It doesn't mean a five-year field program, right? It could be synthesis of existing knowledge, right? It could, you know, because there could be out there, or it could be close to what you need, or, right? So either that, or, and I hate to say this, but use other words for research that make it sound like this is much more doable. Because the impression I got was, oh my goodness, I'm being a bit dramatic here, but all this research has to be done. Well, we'll never get this done. What have we been doing? And I think there's a lot more meat in there than that. And so, now we are a bunch of scientists and engineers, so it's what we do. But I think you could use words like evaluate the available information. You know, you could talk about assess what is known, right? And that naturally leads to, well, if we don't know it, and it's critical, right? Because we don't know a lot. But a lot of it we don't need to know that well, right? There's critical things we need to know. And so some way to kind of, I think, just make the tone more that this is doable. We know quite a bit, but there's critical things we still need to know and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, that was kind of my reaction to it. And, you know, coming from fisheries, when we go into a meeting, we don't say research much at all. We talk about assessment, evaluation, all these things, but they're under the broad umbrella of research, right? It's seeking knowledge, right? So anyway, that's my comment.
Okay, yeah, that's helpful, because getting your impression there's going to be others who are impressed the same way, probably.
All right, Obe.
Yeah, Tom and everyone, it's a nice report, I think. I'm going to ask a question, and if it is outside the scope, just ignore that. So my question was, in the problem statement, Tom, you identified some of the drivers that could be, you know, affecting the system in the future. But I was curious if there's a research need to understand what happens to the subsidence issue in the future under various scenarios, and in particular, these strategies that we are going to use, they have to be dynamic in nature because system itself is evolving due to what I call non-stationarity. So I was wondering if there's a research need to understand what happens if you do nothing to address that.
Yeah, if we do nothing, then the levy solution is the solution.
So to
and they
highlight
just need
the,
to get bigger and bigger and bigger over time. Taller and taller, yes.
So there's a simple long-term answer here.
Yeah, but should that be in the, maybe it shouldn't be, it probably is beyond the scope of this report, but understanding, okay. Yeah.
Can I just ask a clarification question about your question? Are you suggesting that potentially the do nothing scenario though includes substantial sea level rise and
all of the
sea level rise, maybe the problem is solved?
No, all of the drivers. You could have higher groundwater levels, intensification of rainfall, and all of the drivers. What happens under future conditions, and how long will these strategies last in a changing environment? I don't know. That sounds to me like a research question, but maybe it doesn't belong in here. I don't know.
I think
it might be an adaptive management.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a fair question.
I think it comes to the other report, decision making under deep uncertainty.
Right.
I mean, maybe we just point out what are the deep uncertainties, earthquakes,
Well, if I could just respond to that a little bit, I think, you know, we don't want the DMDU approach to be isolated. It applies to all problems, really. And so I think I would support Obe in this. Like a key question here is, if you were imminently successful at promoting, say, polluticulture, would it be sufficient to overcome the climate change effects, right? And so it does seem like when you're talking about the landscape stuff, that, you know, it's scale in space and time. Is it really? Yeah.
I think that's a good point. And I think that is something that we could incorporate easily into the landscape scale summary. Perhaps the reason you don't see it in here is that we were really intentional on trying to draw directly from the workshop and what we heard at the workshop, and that this is a report that reflects what we heard at the workshop. That said, we're also using our own expertise as board members and our familiarity with the literature that ties into each of these findings to then interpret that information and synthesize it in a way that's usable. So that the fact that question maybe didn't come up as a key issue at the workshop, you know, I don't know, we could go back and look at our notes and see if it was there, but we can also make a choice as a board to use our expertise on how we're thinking about uncertainties to add that into the landscape scale question, and even just recognizing that temporal dimension that you mentioned, Lisa. Right now we have the spatial dimension of the landscape scale issues highlighted, but we don't have that temporal dimension.
Right. It could be a hard question to answer. So maybe just raise the question or the need to address the question. All right. Is that it, Obe?
I would say that the farmers and some of the people who are at the workshop are really in the here and now and this near term reactions. That was a key theme that I thought was really helpful.
I think recognizing that temporal dimension early on in the problem statement with few statements might be adequate, and I don't think this needs to be a big issue because the report as itself is trying to come up with some near-term solutions. But I think if you recognize the system is non-stationary and there needs to be either adaptive management type or adaptive pathway type strategies in going forward. So anyway, don't need to spend a lot of time, I don't think, on this one.
Yeah, thanks, Obey. Bob.
Great, thanks, Lisa. I think there's a lot to like about this report. I was really impressed by its comprehensive of the workshop. I really like the structure of how you're presenting the findings and the recommendations for the most part. And, you know, I think it's crisp. It reads pretty darn well and gets to the point. So anyway, with that said, I do have a couple of suggestions for you to consider. And the first suggestion really mirrors almost exactly what Kenny said. My impression after reading through part one is I came away and what resonated with me were the words, gosh, they use the word research a lot, they use the word studies a lot, and they use monitoring a lot. And those are non-starters for me. And I believe they're also really non-starters for a lot of managers, because as Kenny said, you know, they really don't know what you mean by using those words. They're just, in a way, they're vague and big, and you, like, you don't know very much, and we have to start over again. And, you know, anyway, everything that Kenny said and probably more. And like Kenny, I tend to try and avoid those words whenever possible and try to use more, I guess, action-oriented words, like discovery or acquire knowledge or explore, you know, something to substitute for this. And anyway, that's point number one, and I agree with Kenny on that one. Point number two I think it would improve it for managers if you added a table to part one that actually summarized the recommendations. As they are, they're all good recommendations as near as I can tell, but they're kind of buried within the text. And I was thinking afterwards, gosh, it would have been great to have a summary table right up front or at the end, or maybe in the middle of that section or at the end, you know, that I could just glance at, you know, it's a one pager and, you know, here's what they're talking about in terms of the kinds of knowledge that's needed. And also as part of that table is to offer some suggestions for priorities. There's a lot of information, or there's a lot of wants in that first section. We want this, we want that, we need to know this, we need to know that. And I think as a decision maker, I would know which one to start on, to tell you the truth, other than you start on them all, but that's kind of big and cumbersome. But can we as a board offer suggestions for priorities going forward? How might we proceed at least over the next decade? What needs to be done first? And maybe, it all needs to be done first, but you know, which, you know, is there a stepwise progression that we might offer to give the managers and decision makers some idea on how, you know, they might proceed going forward. But anyway, that those are suggestions, you know, take them or leave them. As I said in the beginning, I think there's a lot to like about this report. I think you guys did a great job summarizing, you know, what went on at the workshop and the literature and so forth. And anyway, basically, I just like it a lot. And my suggestions are to help you provide a little more, I guess, clarity in terms of communication. So anyway, thank you.
Bob, a quick question. Would you be satisfied with a table that is primarily the themes and it doesn't get too much to the priorities, but describes what the problem is we're trying to solve?
I'm not quite sure I understand completely, Tom. You mean just have a, these are the three or four themes that...
Well, there's four themes.
Yeah, four themes. I'd like to see a little more detail within those themes. What would you do, say, highest priority within those themes?
Yeah.
You know, just maybe just one line or something to give a sense of where the monies might go or the efforts might go, you know, to get this started.
Okay. What about a theme with an example?
I don't know. It might work. It might be okay. Let's just see how it plays out. If you adopt my suggestion, play with it a little bit and let's see what you come up with.
Okay.
Bob, can I follow up just real quick on the priorities thing? Because I think it's a really important point that you're raising, and it comes up, I think, with a lot of our reviews. When we make recommendations, we often don't prioritize them, or there's several recommendations and they all seem important. And you make an excellent point that if these are going to be usable, it might be nice to highlight which ones you should start with or what might be the low hanging fruit, so to speak. It can be challenging though for us as a board to make that call, because there is some judgment that, subjective judgment that has to go into that as to what we might think is most important. And I don't know, do you have thoughts on the best way for those priorities to be determined?
Tanya, you're absolutely right, because I'm struggling with this in terms of the Food Web report, that on one hand, the community wants priorities, and the way we set it up on the Food Web report, and I think this is a good way to go, I hope it is we offer some suggested priorities or actions, initial actions, and they may or may not, the community may or may not agree with all of these, but it gives them a sense of what we think are the most important initial steps going forward. And I think as a board, in a way, that's kind of one of our challenges is we're supposed to have this great overview of everything. We should at least offer something for discussion. It's not to say we should be making priorities, that what we say is the truth, that it should be acted upon, but rather we start the discussion, and then eventually the community, I think, will determine, what gets done. But I don't see anything wrong personally with offering suggestions for, the initial steps. Maybe we don't even label them as priorities. We just label them as suggested first steps or something like that.
Can I jump in as well? Again, Bob, thanks so much for your comments. And one idea I had as I was rereading this in preparation for this meeting is that in the biogeochemistry section, we didn't get across as much as I would have hoped, this idea that a little bit more site-specific knowledge, data, real information could go a long way. So when we talk about, for example, year-round monitoring, just 2 years, not a forever monitoring program, but 2 years of knowing what happens in the winter would be great. And similarly, a simply structured model that helped look at some of these trade-offs with these various greenhouse gases could be a useful visualization tool. So I could kind of rewrite some of this to make it more near-term, in the same way that we are trying to emphasize near-term options. Would that kind of approach to revising this without having a bit be twice as long, which is the other challenge?
Of course.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a good way to go. I've always believed in, that we should kind of set initial timelines. We should have, say, a 5-year proof of concept, or we should have a 5-year demonstration sites, or, something that lets the community know we're not asking for a never-ending program that just goes on and on and on, and but rather there are milestones here that we want to take a look. It's so important that we look at something, but we need 2, 3, 4 years to really understand it better, and then that's our proof of concept. And then once we've got that, then use that for the next phase. Maybe we fail. Maybe we can't. Some of these things can't be done very well. We just don't have the technologies or the people. And so we acknowledge that after a couple of years that, this is a gaping, well, not a gaping hole, but rather this is a great opportunity, for the community to fill that gap. Yeah, so anyway, I think that would be a that I think that would help.
Okay, that was a helpful conversation. Any other questions from the folks working on the draft about this topic? Okay, all right, let's move on to Inga's comments. Oh, sorry.
Okay. Thank you, Lisa. I thought the report reads really well, and it keeps your attention going because you never know what comes next, kind of thing. So that's really cool. You talk about the conversion to rice farming as an important tool that could really help either stop or reverse subsidence. But and you talk about benefits and trade-offs and that those have to be investigated, et cetera. So it could fall under that. What I'm really missing is the effect of or the potential effect of nutrient and pesticide runoff on water quality. And I think it was mentioned in the workshop, maybe not as a major topic, but it was brought up at some point, not by me. And I'm not sure some people here might remember that pesticide or runoff from rice fields was responsible for a lot of fish kills in the 80s and early 90s. And then after that, a lot of people got together and worked on solutions to minimize that. But it is a concern. And I'm not sure if you could fit it in somewhere, but I just, there was no mention of it at all. Whereas, the methyl mercury issue was mentioned in under panel 4, I think, under the summary. So I think it's an important point to make that this should be monitored because, pesticides used change and the lessons learned from the 90s might not apply anymore. So just drawing a little bit of attention to this topic would satisfy me, I think.
Maybe this could happen in the landscape scale section. You see, because the pollutant transport within the whole system would be a context for this. So that's a thought.
Another
It could
place where we might,
run.
another place where we might put it is, I think we're going to have to say something about the amount of water that's required. We didn't talk too much about it at the workshop, but the evapotranspiration from a wetter delta is an important consideration, and water quality could maybe be worked into that as well.
Yeah, I think when we talk about better understanding those cost and benefits of rice cultivation, those potential water quality impacts could be drawn out as potential costs, for example, or impacts on the system that we need to pay attention to.
Yeah, just sometimes you give examples of trade-offs and things. It could fit in there. something like that.
Of course, the current farming practices also involve these same pollutants. It's relative to the current farming.
Right.
Yeah. And one very minor point is the units used in various sections. mostly you use imperial units, but there are some sections where you use metric units. And then there's a teragram that I actually had to look up. It's a million tons. So, but you know, with Google, it's not a problem. So, but you may want to check on that a little bit.
We will standardize on the units because we're still in an editing mode. We just used whatever the author used.
Yeah, I figured that. Yeah, I don't know. It's not a big deal.
Yeah. Well, for a general audience, like farmers, are imperial units going to be more accessible?
I think so.
Yeah, and for a politician. Yeah.
Okay, good. Thanks, Inga. Virginia.
Well, as for the units, often in these kind of reports, it's useful to give both because people come from different fields. And as for the polluticulture issue, Tanya, I think you said it better than I saw it in the report. The report says rice 52 times. And I think there are other forms of polluticulture. As you said, you kept saying rice and other forms of polluticulture. And so, you know, looking at the native vegetation and ways that it can be used would reduce the use of pesticides and herbicides if those come to bear. So I think that's one issue that you could think about in the way that it's written. My second point deals with kind of my pet peeve that you may not accept, but I really dislike the wording of landscape scale. I think of landscape as a perspective that includes spatial variation. And when you start that section, it starts about regional differences, and then it talks about landscape scale this. And I think you could just say landscape in a lot of places, because to me that brings in looking at spatial variations over the area you're focusing on and doesn't imply a particular footprint. Is that clear?
Yep.
Okay. Anna.
Yes, thank you. Some of what I was going to say has been covered already, but the main point I want to come back to is the recommendations. And I share some of the same concerns that Kenny and Bob brought up. But my suggestion is, I wonder whether it would be helpful to essentially organize the recommendations or break out the recommendations to more clearly separately highlight those that point to needs for improved understanding, whatever we call it, whether you call it research or something else, versus ones that are more directly actionable on shorter timescales. So recommendations for things that, you know, we learned about things during the workshop that just work. And frankly, were it not for the workshop, we might not have known about them. We might not have heard about them. And it makes me wonder to what extent some of the knowledge about, for example, the walking wetlands and other such approaches are not as broadly known as possible. And so, and this would come into the recommendation. So my high level recommendation is, you know, these recommendation paragraphs are pretty dense and pretty blocky. To think more explicitly about which of these recommendations are really, we need to develop a deeper understanding of X, and that can be one grouping for, you know, each of the sections that has recommendations, versus here are either, you know, recommendations for things that could be done now, or recommendations at least for things that could be piloted now. And I think that would address partially the concerns that Kenny and Bob were bringing up, but also it would make this report more usable from a practical standpoint more quickly.
Anna, just a quick follow-up on that. When you say things that could be piloted or used, you know, one thing we had a lot of discussion around when we first started drafting the recommendations was, you know, our role in focusing on the science as a science board versus policy and rec management recommendations for management actions. But there's obviously a fuzzy line there. There's things that can be done to pilot to allow us to get the type of experience or knowledge or information we might need for how something's going to work.
Yeah.
So that the piloting is a form of knowledge or data gathering or evidence that can then inform management. Is that where we're going with that? I just want to make sure I'm clear on how you're thinking about this difference, because to me, it's all about understanding too. And those are, you're doing something that's piloting versus a long-term research program. We're still trying to understand what's working, what's not working. And it's just different temporal scales or sometimes different geographic scales.
But I hear you. I at the same time, I share this concern that both Kenny and Bob brought up, that if all these reports always say is, you know, here is a long list of things that we don't yet know that we need to know, then it's hard to see the light at the end of the tunnel where a body that would be empowered to implement changes would feel empowered to do so. Mm-hmm. When I read the recommendations, it's a list of all the things that we don't know. I agree. It's a fine line, right? You know, at the same time, I do think there are places where, you know, we could do this. I mean, we could say, and again, using the walking wetlands as an example, that was one of the areas that I found so exciting and so promising during the workshop itself. I found it really interesting and somewhat ironic that on the one hand, it seems to be such an effective tool, and at the same time, and the report speaks to this, it's partially a way to get around the complication associated with the regulations for actually establishing wetlands. And so what does that mean? Does that mean that ultimately someone needs to think about, and not us, but someone needs to think about changing the regulations around how one establishes wetlands? Or does that mean that someone inadvertently, people have discovered something that worked really, really well, and it just so happens to also be easier from a regulatory standpoint. Based on what we learned at the workshop, what do we think about, from a scientific standpoint, what the role is of these walking wetlands? And what is our recommendation, again, scientifically, with regard to their role going forward? I completely hear you. And of course, I agree, Tanya, with your perspective that there's this fine line between what we can and cannot recommend, but in reading the report, the things that I felt that I learned and that we heard about at the workshop were in many cases so much more concrete than some of the things that are in the recommendations. And I'm just wondering if there's a way to bring those together, and at a minimum, the minimum that I'm recommending is, even in the recommendation you have here, break out the ones that are really calling for a long-term study versus ones that could lead to changes on a more practical timescale. And even just calling out, you know, this is something that we won't really know about until we study it for 10 years versus this is something that if we just jumped on this now, we would be in a much better position in 2 years to know what to do.
So thanks very much, Anna. I have a comment. And, you know, we've just heard about this $60 million worth of proposals and only $6 million and the need for this very rigorous scientific review. It, you know, if our report could help a farmer who might be on the review committee decide, well, I really want somebody to spend money on this to help me out in 3 years, would they be able to see that information by having read our report? Now, I don't know if there's any farmers on the scientific review of the involved in the scientific review of these proposals, but you know, that's just a concrete example of, I think, what you're trying to get at, helping the participants at the workshop know specifically what are the research or scientific studies, even if we don't use research, that they should be, they might be interested in advocating for now.
That would enable action on timescales that are, you know, on the order of a, you know, single hand of years rather than multiple hands of years. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe we do have at least one public comment on this. Let's go to those, and then I think we can circle back to this, you know, how to handle the selection of recommendations. So Edmund, you want to?
Yep. And we currently have one public comment, but just a reminder for folks, if you want to provide a comment or a question, use the raise hand function. So we now have two. So we'll go in the order that I'll call your name. First will be Campbell Ingram, then Gilbert Cosio. If this is the first time where you're presenting to the board, feel free to briefly introduce yourself before providing your comment or question, but this is optional. Campbell, you have the ability to unmute your microphone. Thank you.
Great. Good morning. Can everyone hear me?
Yep.
It's a pleasure to be here this morning. Thank you. My name is Campbell Ingram. I'm the executive officer of the Delta Conservancy. And I definitely want to thank the ISB for taking on this effort. We've been focused on subsidence in the Delta and working on subsidence in the Delta for a very long time. I do share some of the concerns from Kenny, Bob, and Anna that you know, it feels to me like we are actually in implementation phase at this point. There's so much going on in this space. So much has happened since the workshop and since the inception of this review that I just kind of wanted to quickly go through and highlight some of the key things that have happened. There's about 17,000 acres currently in process of being converting to rice and or managed wetland cultivation in the Delta. DWR has converted 2,000 acres already, and they have certified carbon credits for that activity. They are not selling those credits yet, but they have actually gotten them approved by a third-party verification process. The Nature Conservancy has converted to 4,000 acres of rice on the lower half of Staten Island and is in the process of converting another 1,000 acres of managed wetland. They have also gone through the process of validating that project, and they will intend to sell carbon credits for the 1,000 acres of wetland moving forward. In the last year, we've put about $36 million out on the landscape, projects that will result in 11,000 acres of conversion. We're working with the Nature Conservancy to run a program to incentivize farmers to convert up to 5,000 acres of rice cultivation in the Delta, helping them pay for costs that will offset the land conversion costs, between $400 and $800 per acre to help them level the land, move forward. If they believe they've got, they're just starting that program, but they believe they've got, they will be able to do that very quickly. We paid for the conversion of 5,000, the entirety of Webb Tract. It's underway right now in design phase to convert about 3,000 acres to rice, about 1,000 acres to managed wetland. All of that wetland will be, has to go through the carbon market to be able to generate revenue to offset the loss of agricultural revenue on that project. So those are the things that are happening currently. We expect those large demonstration projects to be very, very valuable for, you know, people seeing that you can manage these islands in a way that stops subsidence, stops carbon emissions, but is economically viable moving forward. We worked very hard to get a 50,000 acre target in the statewide natural and working lands strategy that came out just recently. And that's looking at natural working lands across the state, recognizing that California won't meet our climate objectives unless we can address natural working lands. So a 50,000 acre target by 2045 of re-wetting peat soils in the Delta to stop subsidence. So I mean, I certainly agree there's more we need to learn. Walking wetlands, I think we absolutely better understand the GHG flux when you're rotating lands out of wetlands and back into production. Absolutely. But I do fear that a lot of what this product currently indicates to people on the outside is that we're pretty nascent in this process. And I just don't really think that's the case. My biggest concern is we've exhausted most of our funding. We are working very hard to get federal funding to continue this work. We have a $25 million RCPP grant out right now. And for anyone who might see this report, their sense might be, hey, we're not ready to invest that kind of money to keep this work going. So I would like to see some differentiation about the things that we do still need to learn a lot more about, but also just more recognition about what's happening in the system, where we are, and where we're trying to get to very, very quickly. So I'll leave it at that. And I do appreciate the effort and appreciate the opportunity to make the comment.
Campbell, Tom Holzer, that was very helpful. We probably didn't get enough of the description of what's being done at the workshop, and that probably what affected the way we approached it. But I don't think it'd be that challenging to reorganize so that we can make it clear that we've started on a journey. We just have a ways to go yet. Sure.
I think, Inga, you have a comment?
Yeah,
no, a question for Campbell. Thank you, Campbell, for that. I'm curious if you, how do you deal with the water quality concerns regarding the rice farming? How do you approach that?
I mean, it absolutely is a concern. We know that rice uses a tremendous amount of herbicide and pesticide up in the Upper Valley. And there has been discussion about... I always forget the name of it, but the Irrigated Lands Program, they worked collectively in the Upper Valley to identify best practices and how to manage water runoff. I know the Nature Conservancy is actually on a project that we funded has installed a recirculation pump that actually allows the water to be, brought from one end all the way back up to the top. So you get much more sun exposure and breakdown. Absolutely, it is a concern. But I think that, I'll just leave it at that. It's definitely an issue.
Is organic farming an option or including integrated pest management practices at all? I'm just curious if that's totally out of the picture.
From what I've heard from farmers, it's very challenging in the Delta. My understanding is when you try to grow rice, you're basically accosted by every weed that is known and they come in force. So my understanding is it's challenging to not use the herbicides.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Campbell. Our next public comment is Gilbert Cazio, and then we'll go to Michelle Linfadatter Miles. Gilbert, you can go.
Thanks, Edmund. Good morning, Chair Wanger and members of the Science Board. Gilbert Cosio, River Delta Consulting. I've been an engineer in the Delta for over 40 years, where I've represented about half the reclamation districts in the Delta over my career. And I was on one of the panels for the workshop, and I just wanted to make a few comments. First, I didn't catch the beginning of the presentation, so I don't know if you're talking about a draft that with your edits that come out of discussion today will be eventually sent out to the public or at least members of the workshop that we can also add comments if we see fit, but that would be nice to have. The two areas I want to comment on quickly. The first one is financial, because that's what we're talking about here. It doesn't matter what all the details are. It's just a matter of, can the land produce enough money to maintain the levees and do everything else that these farmers need to pay for? Campbell just mentioned the Irrigated Lands Program. That started out very inexpensive 20 years ago, and it's gotten more and more expensive because they've got to hire consultants to take water quality samples all throughout the Delta and then address them if there are certain spikes in pesticides or other chemicals that they need to reduce. So that used to be very inexpensive, $2 an acre maybe. Now it's very expensive. And so when you look at what a farmer has to do, you can pull out some numbers. You know, we talk about carbon credits and whatnot. If carbon credits produce $100 per acre, and that landowner can rent his ground to a tomato farmer for $500 an acre per year, why would he even try to even think about changing? So when those start getting closer, maybe that's something that should be brought up in this paper, how far apart we are now. It'd be nice to kind of see that. I know recently Restore the Delta put out a paper kind of describing why it's good to change financially, why it's good to change from corn to rice, the financial impacts and improvement for landowners. So that's helping out as far as getting people interested in the program that Campbell just described, that rice program, because as far as I know, it's very, very popular and farmers are eager to do it, but it's got to pan out financially. So I think you won't really have to do a whole lot of research, but I think there's data out there you can gather and just kind of show generally where we are financially on how close we are to changing the way things are happening out there. I think statin's a key component of this thing, because statin is trying really hard to do everything a farming district would do. They are going to do the 1,000 acres of wetland. They're also continuing farming, try to maximize their farming income so that they can pay their bills and keep those levies up and keep their lands drained and whatnot. So that's the kind of stuff I think we could look at and kind of just describe where are we? Are we so far apart that we're never going to get there, or are we closer? And maybe with a few other incentives and some other changes in carbon credits pricing or whatever could change drastically. I don't know. The last point I want to make, and I kind of made this a little bit during my presentation during the workshop, I didn't want to emphasize it because I didn't want to put the kibosh on subsidence research and whatnot. But, you know, subsidence is only occurring in a small portion of the Delta right now, maybe 100,000 acres, which doesn't sound small to you. When we're talking about a 700,000 acre Delta, that's, you know, 15% or less. And if you look at the elevations of the Delta, you can figure it out that, you know, if the lands have been reclaimed on the average of 125 years and the ground is sitting at 10 feet below sea level, it's probably, and hasn't changed in a while, it's probably done subsiding. So it'd be nice at some point, I don't think we have to do it now, to figure out where exactly is it still subsiding and still a problem that we can slow down or change or whatever. So those are the two comments I wanted to address. And I'd be glad to take any questions since I was on the panel. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Gilbert. Those are good points. Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
Gil, to answer your question, what happens with this report? This is just the first draft of it, and it's not really the public draft. That'll come later, and formal comments can be made on it. So we're in the early stages of a rough draft of the report.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. Then we'll have Michelle. Michelle, you have the ability to mute your microphone. Thank you.
Thank you all. I'm Michelle Linefelder-Miles. I'm a farm advisor with the University of California Cooperative Extension, and I too was on one of the panels at the workshop back in October. I just want to echo what Campbell's already mentioned. I haven't had a chance to read the report yet, but I would echo his points about we already have, you know, a pretty good footing of where we are and where we need to go. And I think there is some good momentum within the Delta community to adopt some of these practices already, and many of them, as the two previous speakers have already stated, you know, places like Staten Island, the Nature Conservancy have already been an example, but there's other private landowners that have already provided examples too for the community to see. And then just briefly to comment on the mention of pesticides and nutrient runoff, all growers are required to belong to a water quality coalition, and this is part of the irrigated lands regulatory program that Campbell mentioned. This is a program through the State Water Resources Control Board. Through the water quality coalitions, there's regular monitoring of both surface waters and groundwater For the surface waters, they're looking for pesticides, and for groundwater, they're looking for nitrates. So as Gil mentioned, growers are required to pay a per acre land fee. And yes, that fee has been going up over the years. I serve on a steering committee for the local San Joaquin and Delta Water Quality Coalition. So I know what those fees have been doing over the years. But those fees go toward implementing the programs and the monitoring within that coalition. And so it pays for a company to come out and sample water from surface waterways, again, for pesticide detection and groundwater wells for nitrate. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. It's definitely helpful to hear these comments.
And that's all we have for public comments.
Okay, great. So we have a decision to make at this point. So we can keep discussing for a while here if we want to, say, dig into this issue of how should, you know, what criteria might be used to pull out research priorities or study priorities, however we want to word it. But the main decision we have to make is whether we feel the edits, you know, whether we basically trust the committee to make all the edits we're suggesting at this point, and we approve the report with their intended edits, or whether we want to see another draft. So we have had a lot of substantive comments, but probably, you know, well, I guess it's up for folks to comment. I think this is kind of, in my opinion, this is a little bit borderline. We have had a lot of substantive comments. I do trust the folks that we're talking to address them pretty well, but perhaps there could be some benefit to all of us weighing in on what the research, the short-term versus long-term research needs are. That's the only thing I would think might necessitate having another look before we approve the draft. So, what do other people think?
Well, I think it's helpful to have some board discussion on it. I guess the question is the timing. There's a trade-off of, you know, we want to get this out so folks like Campbell and Gil and Michelle can also read this and comment on it, and that we complete it within a year of the workshop, because it sounds like this is a moving target that we're going to have to also continue to update this report as we go. I hear you, Lisa. I think we're probably somewhere in that middle ground. Can we do this expediently and also still get some feedback from the board on how we pull out these more targeted recommendations or shorter term recommendations or priority recommendations?
Yeah, Bob.
Lisa, I think you're absolutely right about, this could go either way, sitting on the fence, whether we release it or not. But I have to say, I have great trust in the authors of this report. And I think they will do their very best, and they'll be very creative about it, and including our comments in the next version. And so I feel confident if they do that, then it'll be ready to go out for public comment, so that we get back the reactions of the community within a reasonable time frame. Otherwise, it's just going to go on and on and on. And so anyway, I vote for the authors revising it along the lines we've suggested. You know, take our comments and use them if they think they're useful, and get it out to the public, and so that we kind of understand better how the public is going to react to it. So anyway, so that's my two cents.
Okay, that sounded almost like a motion, Bob, but let's hear from others first before we move to that stage. Obe.
Yeah, I think I'm with Bob. I feel like this will go on forever, at least for some time, if we keep having this discussion. I also feel confident that the authors could address some of the comments or most of the comments, except I wanted to ask, is there any value in getting some comments from those who attended the workshop or panelists at the workshop to make sure that we accurately reflected in some way, you know, or their thoughts or their presentations or ideas. I don't know if there's any value to get some sort of a feedback from them in advance of a public release. I don't know if that's feasible, but the other comments I feel like the authors could address.
Mm-hmm. I think the panelists have had an opportunity to look at the summary of the panels. Is that correct, Tom?
Yeah.
So that happened early on.
Okay.
But they haven't, they haven't seen our findings and recommendations to, and I think Gil's reaction illustrated that it would be nice if we could get as many of those people to look at it as possible, just so they're comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm. Anna.
So I too could go either way in terms of looking at it again here versus releasing it for public review now. A couple of last comments. One is I found the public comments particularly helpful in this case. I think, I don't know, maybe Edmund can educate us. For getting feedback from the panelists, I do think that would be helpful. I'm assuming that can just be done during the public comment process where maybe someone like Edmund could make sure to send it specifically to those panelists and express our desire to hear from them. And that might be a way to streamline the process somewhat. My other comment that I was going to make is, because it sounds very much like things are changing very quickly, and we would certainly want to avoid this report putting the brakes on progress that is being made. At the same time, we can't keep running after a process that is already in progress, and we run the risk of going back to square one and starting over. And so potentially a way to deal with that would be to explicitly state at the start of the report that this is a snapshot in time based on the time of the workshop. And we recognize that many things have changed and evolved and moved forward since that time, and that this is not meant to supersede or preempt any of that. It just somehow explicitly call out that this report is based on the state of not just the science, but the state of, I'm not sure what word to use, but management in the Delta situation as it was at the time of the workshop. And since I have the floor, I'm also going to say that I'm sorry, I have to sign off because I actually am releasing a National Academies report that I co-chaired in 15 minutes, and we need to make sure that all the audio and whatnot are working. And I bring this up partially because this is outside of scope here, but as part of that National Academies report that involves NASA to a large extent, NASA made some decisions very late in the process of our deliberations. And similarly, we had this debate as to what do we do with our recommendations that we had come up with without the insight of these new NASA decisions. And that's what we did there, is we said, well, we're late enough in the process that we are keeping our recommendations as they are, but we then acknowledged that they do not take into account these more recent developments. And an approach such as this might be a way to avoid this particular report growing out of hand and restarting the whole process, while also avoiding some of the concerns, which I thought were very important, that were voiced during the public comment period. Lisa, I'm not sure what you would like me to do in terms of voting on any motion that does go forward. I could do it by email if someone emails me, or I could just abstain now, and that way my vote does not count one way or the other. What would you prefer?
Yeah, I mean, we'll still have a quorum. I mean, I'm guessing things will, the vote will be consistent with your views. So I think, I think I just don't include you for now. That's my understanding of what's possible. If we can do it via email, I'll have Edmund do that, but I don't think we can.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Edmund.
Yeah, we can't do vote by email. We'll just.
Perfect.
But we appreciate your comments. Yeah, we appreciate your comments.
This coincided with the launch of this National Academies meeting, so it's a little bit crazy.
Understood. But understood.
Thank you all.
Good luck with that. And
and
then I would just add on just a teeny bit to that, which is just, I think Tanya made a really important comment by saying this is a summary of the workshop too, also not a deep dive into all the science. So I think that's important too. Because like in terms of setting research priorities, one might want to understand the relative risk of different outcomes, and we haven't investigated that. And so I think that's, it might be important to set the scope that way as well. Virginia.
Well, I too can be on the fence about this, because particularly because the timing and because what we heard from the public comments was really important. And I do trust the authors, but I do think there's value in discussing the recommendations. And in view of Anna's last comment, I'm looking at, you know, the first paragraph under findings and recommendations on page 3. And it says, this report summarized findings and recommendations following the workshop held in October 2023. So I think it's clear to, you know, that this is from that workshop. I do think it is valuable to get this discussion. But as I understand it, after public comments, we will have another board discussion that will be very valuable at that time, particularly considering what we hear from the public.
Yeah, that's right. There are chances to iterate on this, I guess. But I think what we heard from the folks on the phone was, or, sorry, whatever we're calling the media by which they contributed, is there could be an impression given that we're nascent versus, you know, ready to act. And I think that is important to not set a tone, a very wrong tone in this draft. So I think that is important. Kenny, go ahead.
So like everyone else, I'm okay either way, but I can offer a hybrid. I guess we don't use that term that much anymore, an intermediate one. There were several of us who brought up this kind of overarching topic about the research and priorities and that there is a lot known already, et cetera. So one thing is the text isn't that long. If you want, maybe there's a subset of us who could go through very quickly, turn around any revised recommendations, really looking for that did it address the concerns about it sounding too research, and not get into a lot, you know, the whole rest of the report, but really focus on that. So that's a kind of an in-between alternative, and we would have to, whoever is willing to do that would have to promise for quick turnaround, like a day or two. So that's an alternative if that helps. Otherwise, I'm good proceeding or not. I do think though that one comment that is an umbrella, but as something the public is going to look at. So. I don't think you want to get all these comments from the public about that when it was kind of fixable beforehand, because it's much easier to respond to our comments than the public ones. You have to document it. You have to interpret it. I'm offering that as a, and I'd be willing to do it. I would do quick turnaround. It won't take that long, but look really surgically about this idea that are there part, it does it sound like this is something doable, right?
Well, we would, the three of us who are leading the report, we would still first edit it ourselves, and then you would look at it. Is that what you're proposing?
That's correct. Exactly. With a focus though on, I'm not going to bring up something else. I'm going to focus whoever does it.
Well, let's let Lauren weigh in here. I feel like she's going to tell us what the appropriate process is.
Oh, she's been very quiet.
Yes. Well, one of the things I was going to point out is some of us, and I'm specifically meaning Dylan Chappell and myself, have, you know, a big thing that the science program supports and that's been supported in the Delta system for a long time by scientists is this adaptive management approach. And we actually think that, and if you go way back when to Mike Healy, who was an advisor to the CalFed Bay Delta program way back when, and wrote an adaptive management diagram where he emphasized using, and we have this in our current diagram for the Delta Delta Plan, he emphasized research scale, research pilot scale, and full scale implementation as part of the adaptive management process. And Dylan Chapel and myself and maybe others feel that one of the best examples of using that approach is for this subsidence reversal, because that's exactly how it was done. If you go way back to these projects in the 90s that Steve Deverill was part of and I was actually part of, we did the research scale, then we brought it up to the pilot scale, and now it's been going into full-scale implementation. And so I think that could be part of what we're hearing about, that it's ready for full-scale implementation, but there's still more to learn. And so I'm just wondering if maybe acknowledging that adaptive management and it's kind of balancing the two a bit, right? That there's, sure, and as Campbell and others said, we're ready for this. And even with the rice now, that's kind of similar thing. It's gone through that and now it's ready for full scale and people are converting to rice now, but there's still more to learn. And so I'm just throwing out an idea that might be a way to help manage this issue that Kenny and others have brought up about being ready for the implementation, but yet still there are aspects to learn and maybe trying to couch it. One of the things that I think it says in your current review is something about fine-tuning the landscape approach to wetlands versus rice versus other kinds of management. And so it's at that level. So maybe a way of pointing out that balancing, if that makes sense. So I don't think I'm really solving your problem, Lisa, but just pointing that out as a potential solution for the lead authors to consider.
We're basically in an iterative loop where there is some implementation going on, but we have a lot of learning. And so, I think that is helpful.
And then emphasizing that the learning can occur and I think should occur where those projects are being implemented at whatever scale they're being implemented.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about the Eddy Covarrubias towers, those really need the larger scales to really get good data. So and pilot plots could be implemented on a full scale implementation project for focused learning.
So I just wanted to jump in and point out that the first line of the recommendations under the biogeochemistry section was for farmers and other land managers to effectively fine-tune management of subsiding land. So that's where the fine-tuning idea is right up. We could still bring it out more in the introduction and bring that idea to carry through, but that was what, and so that's the first sentence, and then the rest of the recommendations seem very broad. So we need to kind of reconcile these, is what I see a way to edit this, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. That's good to hear. Obe, go ahead, but I want to also check in with Edmund and Lauren about process. Go ahead, Obe.
Yeah, real quickly, and I think the report, what I heard from the public comments is that there's already a lot happening. And we, you know, I think as some have said, you know, this look all, you know, look researchy type. But I think if we have a section on what's happening, if it is not there already, you know, what's happening on the ground already, and these are the reasons why we may need to understand these new, you know, gaps, I think that might help move forward. And also the adaptive management approach, you know, that Laura mentioned, will also address the temporal, you know, resolution issue we discussed earlier.
Yeah, I think that is nice. And that was a little bit what Gil was suggesting, is we do a little bit of research on describing what's existing. Could be a little inset box. Say, this wasn't covered in the workshop, but recognize this, and here's the research opportunity to build on Lauren's comments. Okay, but just quickly, either Lauren or Edmund, I'm not sure who wants to answer. Do we have a process by which we could do a little bit of board review before we finalize the next draft?
So I think what Kenny was proposing is have the review leads revise it and then have select members quickly review it before it gets released. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that does work, but the only thing is like the timeline, it probably will coincide with a public meeting anyways if we go with that approach. If that makes
so
sense.
It wouldn't be that, wouldn't be that hard to just discuss it again, is what you're saying.
And
it wouldn't
I think
slow things down.
Meaning there would be another opportunity to have another draft anyway. Is that what you were saying, Edmund?
Yes.
I mean, it does seem that given that it's a pretty heavy lift to decide how the research questions can be narrowed and possibly divided into categories of short versus long-term or high versus low priorities, we didn't really quite settle on that. I mean, if it doesn't slow it down much, it does seem to me there is value in having us take another look.
Yeah. That's my recommendation. Because as Edmund pointed out, the timing is going to be about the same anyway.
Yeah, because for these public meetings, we typically can't post the documents like the day. Ideally, we don't want to do that, but we could circulate it with it. But like for a formal comment period, we want to do like 60 days. But for like these public meeting discussions, it'll be a pretty quick turnaround to have a board discussion like this again.
And if I can just point out, that's still going to require prompt responses from the review leads to get there. So Edmund and I are also very familiar with, we know you're all very busy, but with how much time that's going to take anyway.
How not prompt we are. Yes. Okay. That's fair. Okay. All right. Well, I mean, given that I know I hear from a lot of people that they're ready to delegate this to the committee and, or not the committee, the folks who've been leading and they want to see this get out, but it just doesn't seem like there's much of a difference here really. So we could avoid the vote right now and just say, let's go ahead and let them iterate on a draft. And then hopefully it will be in great shape at the next meeting. And that's the same time it would be ready to go out for public draft if we can approve it at that time.
To clarify though, if we are going to discuss it again at the next meeting, there will be more public comments. People will be commenting all the time, every time we have a meeting.
Yeah, I don't know how much energy there is out there for more public comments, but yeah.
No, that's my, I mean, there was a lot of energy at the workshop making a note here.
Yeah, well, that's fair. And we can evaluate how to balance.
And I also, just to remind everyone, the vote that you take will be a vote to release it for official public comment.
Right.
And then there'll be one more draft before you finalize it, responding to that public comment. So
exactly. Yeah, exactly. So we're not opposed to more public comment. We're seeking more public comment. Yeah. Yeah. But I think Diana's, the point is we'll try to keep it very close to whatever version you come up, come up with in the next round, but we'll have this opportunity to just weigh in on how the priorities were, or how the research got synthesized, the research recommendations got synthesized and altered. She looks pretty dubious. I think we can make this work, Diane. I really do. That
right.
I think we can make this work. And I have just a few little wordsmithing things that I'm going to send in just to let you know. Not only wordsmithing, just some clarification things as well. I feel, and I'll just say this, there's a little bit of a tone of, it seems like we're trying to write for a general audience and not, non-technical audience. And then occasionally this super technical term will just pop in and there will be sentences where it doesn't really explain the connection between the technical part and what you just said in common language. So I just have some comments along those lines to address.
I'd also like to say, in terms of the biogeochemistry section, we do need to have more effective figures for figure two and figure three. And, I can't make those figures, those improvements myself. So maybe Lauren or Edmund or however this is going to happen, it could be happening in this interval so that it's, once there is a vote, we can send it out for public comment, because, figure three is really not accessible at all.
Yeah. Diane, if you have notes on how you want those modified, just send them over to Lauren and myself, and then we could work with a graphic designer on that.
Okay, but yeah, that could be happening in this window. And it seems like the comments that are coming from the other members of the board are not related to those two figures. Okay, thanks.
Oh, I had comments on those figures. I
Okay,
just didn't work them into
but
the public comments. But yeah,
please
I think
go ahead and send
yeah.
them because this will take
Yeah.
some back and forth and we should get started on it.
Yeah. So my comment on figure two was that there's really just no explanation of what the different management scenarios are and what the trade-off, really describing the trade-offs, except for having people interpret the pictures. So I was just suggesting more detailed figure captions, although figure three, I baffled me completely. So yeah. So this is why it's good to have an economist review the biogeochemistry section. Okay, so all right, so then we will not take a vote at this time. We will turn it back over to the folks who've been working on it, and they will give us another draft, but we will they you know they've had a chance to hear what we have to say, and we're going to make many fewer comments next time, if any. So that's our main goal. Okay, is everyone okay without any last comments on that? Concerns? No, got a thumbs up from Tom. Okay. It's great. So let's move on then to our next agenda item, which is public comments for matters not on the agenda, number eight or seven.
There are none.
Okay, great. And then I'll just briefly describe our preparation for upcoming Delta ISB meetings. So in August, we'll now be discussing this. We'll have a Delta Stewardship Council chair and executive officer report. We'll have the revised food webs draft, potentially, maybe not. We will elect the chair-elect. We will hear from the DMDU scenario developers about their user interviews, highlights of those discussions. And then we'll discuss some future reviews and activities. And of course, this is subject to change, but that's what we're thinking right now. And then for September, we're imagining the final environmental impact report comments will be available for discussion. And it's another chance for the food webs draft if it's not ready in August. And we'll hear from Lisa Marie to give us her, that's the Delta lead scientist, to give us her vision for the Delta Science program since she's been in the position now for a little while. And so that's what we have on the agenda so far. I think we are also waiting for other things to be ready to join the agenda. And now I think I turn it over to Edmund. Well, are there any public comments on future meetings?
Yeah, no public comments on future meetings, and I can take over the report for follow-up items. So
Perfect.
for food webs, the review leads are working to address public comments, and then a revised draft report will be released soon for discussion. For DMDU, the review leads are also working to finalize the seminar synthesis summary, and then there will be a presentation on some of the interview highlights at the August meeting. The biggest follow-up item is for this meeting is on the subsidence review. I think we originally set out a target to get individual written comments from ISB members on the current draft by July 22nd. So do we still want to keep that, because at least you still have written comments to submit, right?
I can, yeah.
Okay, so let's keep that, and then the review leads will take comments from today and any written feedback and turn around a draft for August discussion and approval. That's all I have for follow-up items for today.
That
And
sounds
there are
good.
no
And then we just have to be cognizant of other deadlines that you've already expressed to us. So, yeah, I will definitely send my comments. Okay, great. All right. Well, with that, I believe we'll check in once more about any other public comments.
There are none.
Okay. Well, with that, we are adjourned. Thank you all for a great discussion. Kenny's celebrating. And if you're in the midst of a heat wave, I wish you the best of luck staying cool. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.